4:55 on Monday, November 14th. Okay. I did. I remembered it. I got a new one. It's got its clip on it. So I I like them a lot. But and I guess you can't go wrong for $20 if it lasts a year. let's see. So, any questions about the project? Everybody, I don't think I've seen enough turn-in messages to think that everybody has turned it in. Am I? Everybody turned it in?
I haven't.
Okay. Okay, good. Let's see. So, the exams are not graded. Hoping for Wednesday, latest Friday. That will be done. Has to be done. The first project and now the second project are both not graded. So hopefully that will be done by the end of break. I need break to catch up. And what else? Last project. So I have a last project that we've used before, which is essentially a web proxy server that people have had fun with and struggled with and so forth. But I'm thinking that I want to give you guys the opportunity to do something else instead, if you wish to. So if you have a networking project, sort of the scale of the two that we've done so far, and the proxy is about the same. If you have a networking project that you would like to do, I'd be open to entertain proposals for that by email as an alternative to the... I'll give you the proxy project, but if you have something else that you want to do that has your interest, I'd be open to proposals for that as well. So give that some thought over the next week or so and let me know if there's something on your mind as a networking related project, as a final project for the class. As a third project. It isn't really a final project in the sense of being any more important than any of the other ones. But so, you know, some of the things that I think would be interesting would be like a simulation that shows the of TCP that shows that equal sharing behavior. That would be fun. I don't know, an application, a people like doing chat systems sometimes that people can use, a game, a networked game. There isn't anything sort of specific now that has to be done in terms of particular programming techniques. We haven't talked about the multi-threaded server yet. We will. The forking server model actually is what we use in the proxy server project. But I don't insist that you do that. It's a pretty easy one to pick up. So if you don't do it this time, you can do it some other time. Yeah. Yes. I will. We'll talk. We'll even talk about it before Thanksgiving break. But anyway, if you have a thought about something, don't put it off too long, because after we come back from break, there are only 2 weeks of classes left. So the semester is gone. Boom. All right. Any questions about anything? Okay. Well, let's talk about wireless for a day or two. And wireless and mobility, we'll do that for a couple days. And probably by the time we talk about the exam and talk about the project, that'll pretty well occupy this week. And so after break, we'll talk about security. So, obviously, wireless and mobility is big these days. we're all running around with multiple devices that connect to the internet through 802.11ish network connections, through the phone system. We're plugged in people these days. So raises two issues. One is sort of aspects of the wireless communication itself. This is sort of a further extension of the kind of techniques that we talked about for Ethernet. And then the issue about how do you deal with communicating with somebody who's on the move? How do you find them? How do you stay connected to them over a period of time? So the roadmap, we'll talk generally about wireless links and their characteristics. We'll talk about the wireless Ethernet techniques. We'll talk a little bit about cellular, but since I am by no means expert in this, it will necessarily be sort of a high-level, superficial view. And then we'll talk about issues of mobility. So, terminology, wireless hosts. These days, of course, your computers, your iPhones, your other smartphones, and some sort of networking infrastructure to which they're connected through base stations. So base stations can be connected to the overall internet. That's what, to me, makes it interesting when that happens. Isolated wireless networks are generally not so fun. And the, well, I'll save that remark for when we talk about 802.11. Of course, wireless links are the essence of being a wireless network. Radio, almost exclusively. I don't think anybody's doing infrared wireless links these days. Once upon a time, people thought that would be a good idea, but moved on to radio. Of course, the issue with wireless is that essentially we're all sharing the same medium. Everybody within a room, within a campus, is somehow sharing the same medium, and we have to pay attention to this media access control issue that cropped up first on Ethernet and now in a different setting. Okay, so what do we care about in wireless links? We care about the rate at which they go, and this is surprisingly often quoted not in terms of useful rates, but rather in terms of raw rates or signaling rates. So when we say that 802.11g wireless Ethernet runs at 54 megabits per second, when did you ever see a wireless 802.11g link actually give you 54 megabits or even close of useful bandwidth? But anyway. And these typically have, you know, these have ranges in the 10 meter than 30 meter range. I think around this building they have access points at much more frequently than 30 meters. I don't know. Do you know? Have you looked around that?
No.
Yeah.
Is that 10 to 30 with line of sight, or is it 10 to 30 included?
The 30 is very much line of sight. The 10 is maybe you can get through some walls with it. We'll talk about what the physical factors are that affect that. The other wireless technologies that are of interest are you can take these same sorts of networks used indoors for Ethernet and run them point to point outdoors with focused antennas that essentially give you a much narrower signal beam than the indoor antennas do. And around here, First Step Internet, for example, provides wireless Ethernet internet service to homes and businesses using that kind of technology. WiMAX, we'll talk about that in a second, and then the various cellular schemes. And notice the book is out of date, 2007. 3G was all they had, and now we're up to 4G, and they don't talk about that. Matt?
Do you know what the like, N, A, G, and B stand for? I'm just being curious.
I think they are merely sequence numbers. Sequence number suffixes. But what happened to C, D, E, F, and H, I, J, K, L, M, I don't know. I think the N maybe stands for next or something. They're just sort of arbitrary names, mostly. It's interesting that 802.11a actually was a higher rate protocol than 802.11b, but it was apparently expensive, and so B came along to be cheaper and also less bandwidth. And then they figured out how to make the 54 megabit service in G be compatible with B in some sense and also cheaper, and then N came along. Okay. So typically, these networks that we have around here are run in infrastructure mode, in which you do have base stations, and you can move around within a service set, as it's called, from one base station to another, and maintain your network connection, which is good. You can also operate some of these networks in so-called ad hoc mode, which means that you have a bunch of laptops in a room and they all talk to each other, but they don't talk to the internet at large. If you go to an airport and turn up your list of available networks, you will often see a number of different service set identifiers that say free public Wi-Fi. They're typically Windows hosts doing, I think, ad hoc networking. It isn't really free public Wi-Fi.
It was a flaw in the Windows architecture. Basically, if you ever tried to connect to something that said free public Wi-Fi, which was the default thing, it automatically make it so that you broadcast the same message. So it was kind of a virus. Windows XP laptop that's ever been opened in an airport
would do that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it wasn't. So nowadays you go in an airport and it says Denver free public Wi-Fi or Seattle free public Wi-Fi. But anyway, ad hoc networks have some use, I guess, but these days in corporate and educational environments there's usually a base station available, and that's to be preferred. If you have to have a meeting on the beach in Hawaii or something and need to have all your laptops connect, you could do this. I don't think I've ever had a use for that in 15 years of doing this. Okay. So the infrastructure versus no infrastructure distinction happens. And there's also a distinction between whether sort of at the low-level wireless layer you're doing sort of single hop wireless or you're actually using the wireless network as a mesh network. In which case, what happens is that you may have multiple laptops, say, all around a room or around a building, and in order to get from one of them to the base station, you have to go through multiple hops on the laptops. That is not a common configuration. That's not the way things are typically done, but there have been some research networks. I think in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the guys at MIT have built a mesh network like this that lets you use your wireless sort of all around town. Whereas in say Mountain View, California, what Google did was they put up base stations all around town and on the light poles, and then you could use the sort of single hop wireless around there. So the other multi-hop, no infrastructure one that is important is, and again I don't have any experience with this, is so-called sensor networks. So the military is very much interested, for example, in flying a helicopter over a couple square miles and dumping out a bunch of sensors that may be along a track that would be used by an opposing military force to infiltrate an area. And so the sensors detect either metal or they detect vibrations. Then they have to communicate that back to somebody who can do something about it. And those sensor networks may use a mesh network amongst themselves because you're just sort of out in the middle of this field. And those networks often they spread out the sensors. They're disposable, and they have a fixed battery life. They run for a while and then they die, and nobody ever goes and picks them up again. Locally, some of the faculty here have been working on sensor networks for Mount St. Helens and the crater up there to monitor the seismic activity and report back what's going on. So those are definitely instances where the multi-hop, no infrastructure networks are actually used.
So when do they actually get out of that mesh of network? Like where is their jump back to the actual larger network?
Maybe there's, maybe they put something on the periphery of the field, or they fly an airplane over it or something to collect the data. In the Mount St. Helens case, I think they come back to a building that's at the sort of edge of the, I don't know, a building or a shed that somehow has lots of solar power, and then they beam the data down to Vancouver campus. I think they're doing
so
that.
They're
yeah.
Slower then?
Yeah, they're typically very slow, because as we're going to say here in a moment, more power is roughly equivalent to a higher bit rate, and so if you want to go fast, it costs you more power, and these devices run on tiny batteries. So if you use more power, they die faster. Okay, so differences from wired length. Decreased signal strength. We talked about this before when we talked about carrier detection and collision detection. We'll see more about that in a moment. It isn't just that signals attenuate as they propagate through matter, right? Signals attenuate as they propagate through space because they spread. And again, I think we've mentioned physics 202, right? When you send out a signal from a given point, the signal strength it's expanding as a sphere, and the signal strength that you can receive at any point is proportional to the square of the distance from the origin point in three space. Whereas on just because the signal is spread over the area of the sphere, so that you start with a certain amount of power, it's being spread over a larger and larger sphere as it expands. Whereas the loss in a wire is pretty much proportional to the length of the wire due to the resistance of the wire. So it goes as one over the distance, and with a interference, of course, everything in the same space can be interfered with. There's no isolation, and the other nasty thing is that a signal may actually interfere with itself, because when you send a radio signal and it hits a certain kind of material, it will get reflected. Okay? And when it reflects, think about the waves. You've seen the pictures of waves and wave interference. You can get destructive or constructive interference between signals of the same frequency. You can get a signal that takes, you know, a direct path between me and Matt is a certain distance. A path that bounces off the wall is a longer distance, so you can actually get a signal that arrives a little bit later. You've driven down the road, especially with FM stations. You've heard probably, and you've heard them fading in and out as you go down the road. Better. Often, I usually notice it when I'm right at the limit of the station and I'm driving like in a traffic jam, right? And so you go from a place where there's constructive interference, there's a good signal, and you go, let's see, FM band is about probably 3 meters wavelength. So you go about 5 feet forward, and then you're in a null, and the signal disappears. That sort of thing is happening. Okay, here's the story about power and signal strength and bit error rates. So, computer engineers, anybody want to give a lecture on signal to noise ratio? No? No takers? Well, okay. So, the more power you put into a signal, the more signal you get, right? And there's also noise present in the environment. So the ability of a receiver to detect the signal that you want is essentially proportional to the ratio between the signal and the noise. And if the signal gets weak enough that it's down sort of at the same amount of power as in the noise, then you can't detect the signal and you can't identify the signal as different from the noise. So the way it shows up in data communication is that when the signal-to-noise ratio is higher for a given type of transmission, you get a lower bit error rate. And so the whole game in wireless is to use schemes that have the games is to use the available signal-to-noise ratio to get as high a transmission rate as you can while maintaining an adequate bit error rate. That's the picture here that we're seeing. So the different colors correspond to different speeds. If you go slower, see blue, then with a fairly low signal-to-noise ratio, you still get a low bit error rate. 1 in 10 to the -7. Now the other thing, of course, that you do is you add some redundancy to the actual messages you send so that you can correct for those bit errors, like we did with the CRC computations. All right? So anyway, the key message is more power, more signal, higher bandwidth, or higher bit rate, and lower bit error rate. That's the whole name of the game. And then computer engineers and signaling guys try to figure out modulation schemes to further optimize that. Yeah?
Is there like an area between
19 and 21? Hmm?
I'm just looking at those lines and the blue ends where the dashed one starts, and then there's like a space between where the blue one starts.
The blue one ends where the dashed one starts.
Or no, the dashed one and then the...
Oh, you're talking here.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's what you're looking at. Well, these are discrete things, right? These are different modulation schemes, all right, and choices of signaling speed. So there's no fundamental gap there. It's just that for these particular three instances, you're seeing a little gap. But it's not, I don't think that's the right way to look at it. Okay. All right. So what happens in wireless networks that's weird. Well, first of all, I don't like these pictures. Right? It's falling off as they're falling off as the cube or as the square of the distance. There's none of this S curve business. I don't know where they came up with that. But it doesn't change the sort of important point. So, two things that happen with wireless networks that don't happen with wired networks so much. One is the so-called hidden terminal problem, you can A and B can talk to each other, B and C can talk to each other, but A can be completely oblivious to the existence of C. Okay? It just can't see because of the obstruction, it can't see the radio signals. And the consequence of that is that if A and C both send signals at the same time, they have no idea that they're interfering at B, because they just can't hear each other at all. Same thing happens just because of the signal attenuation with distance. Two nodes that are close to each other may hear each other, but two nodes that are farther apart may not, and a node in between will hear them both to the point that they cause interference with each other. I'm going to skip this. We'll come back to that, but we need to go from that immediately prior point about hidden terminals and the like to talking about 802.11. So, this is what we use as wire. This is essentially the wireless Ethernet standards. They live in either the 2.4 to 2.5 gigahertz, not 5 gigahertz. Gigahertz part of the radio band. Also living in that space are. Let's see, what else is in there? Portable phones, Microwave ovens. What else? It's a very popular bit of frequency spectrum because you don't have to have a license to use it. And so things have tended to be dumped into there. And so partly what goes on with the design of something like this is you have to figure out how not to be interfered with by all the other things that exist in the spectrum. Baby monitors. That's another one that's in there. Smart grid power meters live in there. Some of them. Etc. Okay. 802.11a in the 5 to 6 gigahertz range. Like I said, you don't see very much of that these days. G and N are the newer versions of B that go faster. You bounce around a bit in frequency as you're doing this, and that's where this chipping code thing comes in. We'll go back and talk about that, but that's not essential. And because of the hidden terminal problem, and because of the characteristics of radio, the CSMA CD, remember that's carrier sense multiple access with collision detection. The collision detection part of that doesn't work because typically the power that a radio transmitter is sending is so much larger than any signal that it receives that it can't tell if there's a collision happening. It can listen before it transmits, but once it starts transmitting, it can't hear what else might be going on. So you can't do collision detection. So there's another technique called collision avoidance, and we'll talk about that here in a moment. Okay, so the base stations here are called access points. The names of the networks, the hosts that are connected to an access point are called a basic service set together with the access point. And you can operate, of course, in ad hoc mode, but we're not going to talk about that. When you walk into a room, have you ever looked at the logs that your, well, I guess Windows systems aren't so verbose about this, but if you have a Linux system, you can look at your system log and see the wireless networks are doing its negotiation, and it will walk into the room. The wireless card will find out about the different access points that are available and the networks that they support, and they will then do a negotiation to associate, it's called, with a particular one of the access points or base stations. And you can see this in your logs as it goes through this negotiation. And hopefully you successfully associate. How does it find out about what's available? You listen for so-called beacon frames that the base stations send out that contain their name and MAC address. How do you choose which one? Let's see. Does anybody have a wireless network sort of mapper on there? I didn't bring my other. I'll try to remember that next time. We can look at what's available in this room. We'll find out that there are quite a few different networks available. There are multiple access points for each network. They have different signal strengths, and you know there's some combination of user's choice about which network to associate with, and then the system will choose the best access point.
Mm-hmm. How does it do that? Is it like programmed?
Yeah, it's part of the driver software for the Ethernet card. In Linux, it's the network manager applet or network manager program is the thing that's doing that choice, collecting all the available networks, asking the user which one to connect to, and then choosing the best access point for that network. Yes, you may have to use authentication in order to get permission to associate with a access point, and that's been a pain in the you-know-what for Linux users around the WSU campus, because it doesn't work right. There's something wrong with the way it's configured on the campus network, and so we have a workaround, but it's not fun. And then, okay, so once you get, so what has happened here? Let's back up a second. So when you associate with an access point, what have you accomplished in our layered network model? You've established something at which layer? I'm detecting a groundswell of support for the link layer. That's right. That's a link layer operation. Once you have that link established, then you can run the higher level protocols like DHCP to get going with the with an IP address and onward to the network layer. Oh yes, these slides. The pictures show it one way, and the words say something different that doesn't make sense, so just fix that. Okay, so you can do this either passively. That's what I described before. The access point is sending out these beacon frames saying who's here, what we're doing, and the host can attempt to associate based on that information. Sometimes network administrators configure their access points to not advertise what's available, in which case you have to know what network you want to connect to. The host then sends out a probe saying, is there anybody here with WSU Wireless, for example? And if there is, then the access points will reply. And then you can do the later steps where you ask to associate and get a confirmation. So that's an interesting point. Why would you not advertise the network's availability? It's kind of a minor security measure, I'd say. It's not a big deal, because anybody who has a bit of smarts and a bit of hacking tools can essentially snoop on this kind of conversation that other people are having, as well as the normal traffic, and figure out what they need to know in order to do this. But it keeps a bit of the riffraff potentially out of your network, but still. The actual security mechanisms for doing associations are better. All right, just hiding is not usually a very good security measure. Multiple access then. So CSMA, Carrier Sense says don't stomp on somebody you can hear is already sending on the channel. Always good to be polite. But there's no collision detection, as we described before. So instead, there's CA, collision avoidance. So how does it go? There's a requirement that you actually listen for a certain amount of time before sending. So that's part of collision avoidance. And if you detect that the signal channel is busy, you do something similar to Ethernet. You back off for a while, and when the timer expires, then you can transmit. This is also a protocol that uses ACKs at the link layer. Why did we say that? We talked about why you'd want to do that. Why links? Why ACKs at the link layer? Ethernet doesn't do that. This does. Why? No, it's actually slower. Come on, guys. Why acts at the link layer here? We didn't use them for Ethernet. We use them here. Why? Well, think about what happens if this transmission doesn't work. The data doesn't get through. Yeah, Dominic.
Well, I mean, Ethernet being a physical connection.
Okay, so the Ethernet is much more reliable, absolutely. You can lose frames, but it's much less likely that you will lose a frame. In fact, it's so relatively unlikely that in experience, the loss of Ethernet frames is low enough that it doesn't interfere with the higher level end-to-end acknowledgement mechanisms, which are important for TCP, because remember, it's loss of acknowledgements at the TCP level that trigger congestion control mechanisms. So what happens here if this data frame is not received? Well, if you don't have a local acknowledgement mechanism, then it's going to just disappear, say, from the TCP stream. Then after a few round trip times, that will be noticed and the whole TCP recovery mechanism will kick in. Okay? So again, having a local ACK here lets us fix the problem locally, is essentially what I wanted to drive at, is that with a high loss medium like wireless, you want to fix the problem locally and not force us to wait for the round trip times, especially because the loss of data here is not necessarily indicative of congestion, right? And that's how TCP is going to interpret the loss, is congestion. So that can lead to sort of nastiness. Okay, so those are two things that we do. Carrier sensing, and then the other thing is that, see, part of the problem is because you can't do collision detection, what happens if sort of at this point there's something coming from the other side that interferes. Well, then we waste the channel for all the rest of this time because there was no collision detection. Couldn't see that. So, instead of sending big data packets and letting them collide, what they do is they send little packets that say, I want to send now. Okay? They're just little tiny things. And if those collide, well, then they're lost and that's fine. But you only wasted a little bit of time because they were small. And so what we do is we send this request to send packet. The base station, if it successfully gets that, says, it's your turn now. And sort of the theory is that, notice that if this thing is working at all, the base station or access point is hearable by all the hosts in its cell, if you will. So everybody can hear the base station. Otherwise, they're not really part of this thing. So because of that, if there's a collision on the request to sends, then a little time is wasted. But they don't hear back. They back off. Then A sends another one. After that, the base station says, okay, A, it's your turn. B hears that and says, okay, I've got to be quiet now for a while. Not send, regardless of what happens, until A has had enough time to send his signal, send his message, and get his ACK. And that's called the deferment period. Okay, I think... Well, let's just look at this. So 802.11 is wireless Ethernet. The funny thing is, it's wireless Ethernet. Remember in Ethernet we had two MAC addresses in each frame, right? The senders and the receivers. 802.11 uses three MAC addresses in each frame. And I was thinking about that this morning. And it's because, essentially, 802.11 is almost like layering another link layer on top of the Ethernet link layer, but not quite. And so rather than sort of layering another set of header information on Ethernet, they just made it a different header. So here's what's going on. When a host is sending a message, it doesn't really want to send it to the access point, right? It wants to send it to a router or another host on this network. So that means it has to put in its MAC address and it has to put in the MAC address of where the message is really going. Okay? So those are two MAC addresses, the ones that would already be there in the Ethernet. But it also has to say, what access point is it going to use? Right? Because there might be multiple access points here. And part of being associated says, I send to this access point. Somebody else might send to a different one. So that's the need for the third MAC address in the 802.11 packet header. Because you have to say the access point, you have to say the ultimate Ethernet destination MAC address, and you have to say your own. So that's unfortunate because, of course, these are slow networks and now we're wasting more information in the headers, but so it goes. All right. Other things in the headers. I always miss this. This stuff is all just an expansion of the stuff called frame control. Then we have the addresses. There's actually a fourth address that's used in ad hoc mode that we won't talk about. But then the payload and the CRC, like an Ethernet frame. Okay. Good. So next time, we will talk about this idea of chipping sequences and code division multiple access. That's sort of backwards in the slide. And go on to talk about mobility. And hopefully I'll have the exams done, but we'll see.